Well, I think the first point is that there's been a lot of reassessment of the restoration regimes after 1814 to 15, and it's now very clear that they were not all the caricatures of black reaction that traditionally they've been held to be. Even a monarch as reactionary as Charles X of France, and believe me, he is reactionary, sees all sorts of good points in the Napoleonic centralized system of the prefects and a centralized civil service, because it actually facilitates the exercise of power. But also, I think a lot of the restoration regimes did have parliaments of various sorts, and the restoration in France obviously lives with a two-chamber parliamentary system for virtually 20 years, and it's almost overthrow, I would say, by Charles X that actually provokes the fall of the regime. So I think in that sense, the restoration regimes, whether in France or Prussia, or not to mention a lot of the German states, particularly the southern German states, which we forget about, like Bavaria and Baden and Württemberg, which have strong liberal traditions right the way through up until 1848, in fact, and do have quite effective functioning parliaments. The restoration regimes, I think, absorb much more of the constitutionalist, of the parliamentary legacy of the French Revolution, which has been exported to these areas of Europe by the French Revolution, than has previously been thought. When, for example, Belgium declares independence from Holland, Belgium sets up a sort of model French-style constitutional, moderate sort of constitutional regime. I think, just as Mike Broers has talked about sort of inner and outer circles of the Napoleonic Empire, I think there are possibly also inner and outer sort of circles of Restoration Europe, in a way, that France and the southern German states, and possibly Belgium and Holland even as well, form a sort of more liberal core. And the further out you go, the more reactionary the restoration states become. Spain is the obvious example, possibly also the Kingdom of Naples, anywhere which is ruled by Russia, I suppose. Except one's got to make an exception for this, because in fact, again, the Congress Kingdom of Poland is, again, understudied, and it's a very interesting example of just how liberal Alexander I, even Nicholas I, could be, relatively close to their own doorsteps. If you're talking about the radical revolutionary tradition, which clearly is excluded even by the more constitutional versions of the Restoration, I think there it's very clear that it goes underground, okay, all over Europe. Hence, there is, one doesn't go as far as Metternich, who was absolutely paranoid and really was convinced in his latter years that there was a revolutionary international coordinated from the catacombs of Paris pretty well. Obviously, that's fantasy. On the other hand, and if you look at books like, now Ambrogio, you're going to have to prompt me, what, The Horsemen of the Apocalypse?
By Richard Stites.
Richard Stites, it is called Horsemen.
The Four
Horsemen of the Apocalypse by Richard Stites.
Riding into freedom into post-Napoleonic Europe.
That is a very important book on the underground revolutionary movement. In a more popular way, Adam Zamoyski's recent book, which is called, and I should know the title of that, it's got Terror.
Phantom Terror.
Phantom Terror. is also deals with this clearly in Spain, clearly in France, in Italy, in Naples, in Piedmont, and also in Poland in 1830. You do have revolutionary movements which are partly independent, but also I think, and this is important, I think they're not, you can't say they're linked by an overall international committee. That's a fantasy. On the other hand, the way in which the international press did actually serve as a link between the various revolutionary movements, so that revolutionaries in Germany did follow what was going on in France and follow what was going on in Spain and Italy and were more informally connected, and by some forms of correspondence and the travelling of leaders between them, I think, yes, you might argue that this revolutionary movement is more, I wouldn't say cohesive, but it is more an international movement possibly than is usually thought by historians. So certainly I would say that the Restoration regimes, the Restoration governments, they are unable entirely to checkmate a revolutionary movement that at a certain moment of international crisis, i.e. 1848, is momentarily strong enough to overthrow a number of them, but I'd underline only temporarily, for a certain period.